Good evening, everyone. It is so glad to be with you. And I suppose very first thing is, I'll give the traditional greetings of my people. So, howdy, y'all. I was told howdy a couple of times, even in the parking lot before I got in here. So, made me feel right at home. I am now from Lompoc, but as you can tell, I haven't been there all that long. We've been there about 2 years. And in that time, of course, we've made some connections to y'all out here. Y'all sent us Megan and Amanda, and we won't hold that against you because you also sent Anthony. And so we are very pleased that the Hernandezes are with us, and them and their two lovely young children, and their third child, which is also, well, here tonight, Megan. Any case, very glad to have the opportunity to come out here. Aside from them, Brother Galloway and I have only met a couple of times, but we have some other connections in common. A good friend of both of ours, and don't tell him I said that, and I won't tell you, John Robertson, Wichita Falls, Texas. He's a good friend of Brother Mickey's, and my brother-in-law is a deacon there where John preaches and has, I guess he's been a member there about 10 or 15 years now. And that's just a little bit east of where I grew up, Vernon. But just west of Wichita Falls. Have you been out there once or twice or three times? Just once to Wichita Falls? That was enough, right? Anyway, I grew up out west of there where it's smaller and drier and hotter. But out there on the Red River is where I grew up in Vernon, Texas, after having been born in Oklahoma City area. And so, because this is the first time here, I'll tell you a little bit about myself, give the very short biography. Born in Oklahoma City, raised out in Vernon, Texas, which is just barely across the river from Oklahoma, almost in the Texas Panhandle, but not quite. Nothing's near Vernon. It's 3 hours from Oklahoma City, from Dallas, from Abilene, from Lubbock, from Amarillo. It's 3 hours from all of those places, none of which you probably want to go to anyway. But we do have tornadoes there. And so unfortunately, the local church just folded, so we had a local church there. But it got down to four folks there, including my parents. So they just recently moved back to Oklahoma and went to where my brother-in-law preaches up there. So was raised in Vernon, and after college preached there for a little while, and then went overseas and did overseas work 3 years when Eastern Europe opened up, when the Berlin Wall fell and Soviet Union collapsed. Brother Derek Chambers was here Sunday with y'all visiting. Hopefully you met him. He and I actually lived and worked together. Lived in the same apartment for a year and a half in Vilnius, Lithuania. So Brother Derek came and saw us Sunday night. We were glad he was able to come out. But so that brother and me and my wife, Becky, who's here, we didn't have any kids then. Had one while we were there and several more since we got back. But we preached over in Lithuania for 3 years. And after that, we went to Houston. And we were in Houston 11 years. And after 11 years in one place, we decided it was time for a change, and we made a big change, and we came out here to Lompoc, and so we've been out here for about 2 years. And Lompoc, well, it's near the edge of the earth. It really is. It's a pretty little edge over there near the Air Force Base and over there in northern Santa Barbara County. But we are out there by ourselves, and there aren't that many churches around, and of those that are places we can go in good conscience without reservation, even fewer. So we are glad that y'all are as close as you are and appreciate the opportunity to come and preach here with y'all, probably because y'all knew some of those people I knew is probably why y'all invited me to come out. They had hopefully confidence in me, and you have confidence in those folks. So because I know you don't open your pulpit up to just everybody. And so I am appreciative of that trust that you gave me and hope by faithful gospel preaching tonight to be worthy of it now and in the future. And hopefully we'll get to know each other better. All right, so having said that then, we go on to tonight's topic. And I was looking at this list of topics for the week. We had yesterday, or you did, the Valley of Temptation and the Valley of Death. And I really thought at first I got a bad draw with the Valley of Despair. But I saw that another brother had to do the Valley of Death. So we are working our way up. Things are improving. Now, I can see that Brother Evans rates pretty well because he gets to take you to the lofty mountaintops of glory on Friday. And so he kind of gets to cap the week and end us off there at the lofty heights of Mount Pisgah and looking off into the Promised Land. But tonight we'll still be somewhat in the valley of despair. And tomorrow, but I do suppose that is better than tomorrow night's lesson. I think probably the valley of despair is probably a better place to be than tomorrow night's lesson, the plains of compromise. If we think about Lot, and I won't go into preaching tomorrow night's lesson, but think about Lot and the well-watered plain leading down to Sodom. And if you have to be in the valley of despair or in the plain leading to Sodom, neither one of them are good places, but this one is probably an easier one to get out of. And so if anything, this would be better than tomorrow night's situation. And then I also see you'll have a question of why do bad things happen to good people? And that is one of the things that I had originally gave some thought to going to in this lesson, was bracing this lesson somewhat in Psalm 73. Now, if you would turn to Psalm 42. Psalm 42. I had thought about bringing in a section about Psalm 73, which is not why do bad things happen to good people, but that's kind of the same question on the other side of the coin. Psalm 73 is why do good things happen to bad people? Why do bad people seem to have it so well so often? And Mercy, you look down here, you know, south and west, for me it's south and east, but look down toward Hollywood and Sodom and Gomorrah there on the ocean, or up north on the coast to the great city north of us, which one day the Lord may reclaim with the ocean. But the wicked seem to be doing pretty well in those places. And that can drive us to despair, and that drove a guy named Asaph to despair until he realized that was a temporary existence and that God would judge and God had set things right. And so if you're worried about that, and if that's not covered on Thursday night, if that angle isn't, why is it that so many good things happen to people that are so manifestly bad, read Psalm 73 and get the lesson there on your own. But because that lesson's going to cover a lot of that, I will not do Psalm 73. I'll go to Psalm 42 and 43, and we're going to spend almost all of our time tonight in Psalm 42 and Psalm 43, and toward the end, we're going to go and learn these same basic lessons for Christians are all repeated in the book of Hebrews. That's one thing that struck me in reading this, is how everything that was laid out in this psalm is laid out for us, maybe a slightly different form, but laid out for us the same things in Hebrews. So tonight, the valley of despair, and, oh, hold on. That's not the valley of despair. That's Bakersfield. I don't know how I made that mistake. And I've only seen Bakersfield once. It was in the worst dust storm they've had this year. Right? So anyway, I still haven't seen Bakersfield, but I drove through it. All right, we're going to use this. We're going to use this picture as our valley of despair. Now, I was told yesterday, see, I'm from that part of the country where it did rain some. One of the brethren said, well, that looks like home. And I realize some of you may think, you desert rats may think that looks like paradise, but we're going to use this rocky, desolate valley where there's nothing out there as our kind of mental image of the valley of despair. There's nothing out there but dirt and a little bit of scrub and just boulders upon boulders. And just try to imagine living out there. Imagine if you're traveling and get stuck there. You don't have your well, you don't have your air conditioning, you don't have your iPhone, you're just stuck there. This is our representation, this desolate, rocky valley that just keeps on going down and twists and turns, and you see the road go up here and over there, and it went on down to the left. And actually, was one of the reasons I like this picture is I was out at this very place just a few weeks ago. I had a gospel meeting in Oakdale up by Modesto, where a good friend of mine from many years preaches up there. And after the meeting, my oldest daughter Lizzie and I, we're able to go up to Yosemite again. That is one of my favorite spots in all of God's creation. There's a friend of mine, she's an evangelical, but she is devout. She says if she were God, that's where she would live. You know, if you made the world, that's the spot. So anyway, Yosemite, and then we went over the top of the Sierras, the High Sierras, and we went down the Owens Valley on the backside to Bishop and Lone Pine and Mount Whitney. And some of those glorious things. It was raining at Mount Whitney, so I only saw the base. I didn't get to see the high part of Mount Whitney. And this is actually a little spot called the Alabama Hills. But when we saw this valley, after seeing so many grand things, Lizzie and I didn't care to spend much time there. I think we pretty much stopped, took a picture, got back in the car, and left. And it's like, why would anybody want to be here? Well, you know what? There isn't anybody there. There's not. I guess people go dirt biking or something out there, but nobody stays there. There's no houses anywhere around. It's not a place fit for habitation. And so chose that then as our representation of the valley of despair. Now these rocky places, you know, now let's talk about literal rocky places. Let's talk about rocky, desolate places in life. The things that happen when we have losses. Maybe financial setbacks. How many of those has this country faced the last couple of years? People losing their homes. I know brethren who are facing foreclosure, and that bothers them terribly. But even worse than that is loss of people. You know, people have had to move to find new jobs, or people get transferred for here and there for various things. Or there's estrangements where relationships are lost, or separations, or there's illnesses. And especially chronic and degenerative things that happen, or the great separation, death. That takes us to the rocky places in life, does it not? That takes us to the waterless places. That takes us to these hard places where there is no rest, there is no shade, there is no place of comfort. There's there's just grief. And a lot of times these things of despair come in cycles. And we'll see one reason tonight why these things come in cycles, and one of them is that Satan likes to kick you when you're down. You know, he doesn't play fair. You know, in sports, we teach our kids when someone's injured, take a knee. You know, but Satan is more like that guy in that Ultimate Fighting Championship. If somebody goes down, go hit him before he can get up. And so that just piles on and makes it worse. And so these things can come, and when they come, they can sometimes just seem like they're going to keep coming, and there's additional loss, and additional losses take it, you know, a compound toll. It just adds to our heartache and our grief. And in Psalm 42, this psalmist, I'm going to say it's David. This is not a psalm that is named, but of the psalms that are entitled, about half of them are David's. We presume a great majority of the rest of them are his too. Anyway, we're going to presume this is David, and we're going to fit it into the events that we know about David's life. But this is a time of great trouble. This is a time of really horrible circumstance. Now, I know, again, just to briefly mention Psalm 73, we can work ourselves into a situation of despair, even when things are not all that bad, if we're envious. Psalm 73, Asaph said, I almost stumbled when I became envious of the wicked. And so we can work ourselves to despair even if things aren't that bad. But let's think about when things really are bad. And in here, in this psalm and the next one, Psalm 42 and 3, things really are bad. And we're going to treat these two psalms as if they're one. And actually, in some editions of the scripture in other places, in other countries, in their versions of the Bible, Psalm 42 and 3 are together. They're not listed as two independent psalms. Thank you, sir. Thank you. What's happened is I'm getting over the flu. I had that last week. And yesterday was my first day of a completely full schedule again, and it's just kind of taking a toll on me, so I'm a little bit slow here, and I'm having a little trouble catching my whole breath. That's really my main problem right now. But all right, so Psalm 42 and 3, we're going to consider them completely together. We're going to consider them as being written by David. They certainly can fit into times of David's life. If not, it's another godly man, another prophet, but we don't know what circumstances. So we'll apply it to the circumstances we know of David. And we just note all the things that are wrong here. So we start with the note. And these notes that are with the Psalms, it says, for the choir director, a Maskil of the sons of Korah. These notes, you know, these notes aren't just added by the translators. These notes actually go back into the Septuagint. So these notes are older than the time of Christ. So I take them as genuine. So this was something written for the choir director and to be given to be sung by the sons of Korah, that professional trained choir at the temple. You know, at the temple, they didn't just have instrumental music. They had the best instrumental music. They had a professional orchestra and professional choir. Because if you are going to do things as the book of Hebrews says, that these things were things that were fleshly or things of the flesh, the temple was made to awe you with the architecture. Some people build churches that way today. In the New Testament, we don't have that kind of form, and we don't have that kind of outward thing to awe one and impress one. We have the spiritual things, which are to awe our soul, rather than to be physically awed by sight and sound and sensation. But in the temple, they had a lot of that kind of stuff. So you could, you'd go into the temple. It was what you saw. It's what you smelled. It's what you could see. It was a very sensual thing. And so this is for those choir, that professional choir of the temple. Let them sing this song. We're going to write this song for them. And if we think about it, the person in this situation that he's going to describe in Psalm 42 and 3 is thinking about what the choir should sing. And so he's taking his mind away from his current troubles, and he's writing a song for the choir to sing. And so let's sing. Let's read with a little bit of comment, but not a lot, all of Psalm 42 and 43. It says, "As the deer pants for the water brooks, so my soul pants for thee, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? My tears have been my food day and night, while they say to me all day long, where is your God?" And so he pants for God. It's like he says, a deer panting for the water. So he's thirsting for God. And what does he get? He gets his own tears to drink. That's how bad it is. He just has his own tears to drink. That's all he eats. Verse 4, "These things I remember, and I pour out my soul within me. For I used to go along with the throng and lead them in the procession to the house of God, with the voice of joy and thanksgiving, a multitude keeping festival. Why are you in despair, O my soul? Why have you become disturbed within me? Hope in God, for I shall again praise Him for the help of His presence. O my God, my soul despairs within me. Therefore I remember Thee from the land of the Jordan and the peaks of Hermon, from Mount Mizar." He says, why do I despair? Oh, I despair. It's like that man that Jesus, after he came down on the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus healed a fella whose son was afflicted with an evil spirit. His son was possessed. And Jesus cast out that demon. And that father in Mark 9 said, he said to Jesus, he said, "Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. Help, I believe. Help my unbelief." Here's the psalmist. Why do you despair? Oh, I despair. Why are you in despair? Oh, because I am. And so he's in real despair and agony here. He says in verse 7, and in verse 7, he almost sounds like Jonah. With Jonah, it was real waters that he was under. Here it's metaphorical waters. Verse 7, "Deep calls to deep in the sound of thy waterfalls. All thy breakers and thy waves have rolled over me." So I've just been inundated. I'm underwater here. You ever felt underwater? Hey, I'm underwater here. Verse 8, "The Lord will command His loving kindness in the daytime, and His song will be with me in the night, a prayer to the God of my life. I will say to God my rock, why hast thou forgotten me? Why do I go mourning because of the oppression of the enemy? As a shattering of my bones, my adversaries revile me, while they say to me all the day long, where is your God?" Actually, that's very reminiscent of Psalm 22, isn't it? My God, why hast thou forsaken me? And you can almost picture the crucifixion in verses 9 and 10. It's that kind of agony and that being kind of surrounding by enemies. Verse 11, "Why are you in despair, O my soul? And why have you become disturbed within me? Hope in God, for I shall yet praise Him, the help of my countenance and my God." And we'll see that exact verse repeated again. Verse 1 of chapter 43 now, Psalm 43. "Vindicate me, O God, and plead my case against an ungodly nation. O deliver me from the deceitful and unjust man, For thou art the God of my strength. Why hast thou rejected me? Why do I go mourning because of the oppression of the enemy? O send thy light and thy truth. Let them lead me. Let them bring me to thy holy hill and thy dwelling places. Then I will go to the altar of God, to God my exceeding joy. Upon the lyre I will praise thee, O God my God. Why are you in despair, O my soul? And why are you disturbed within me? Hope in God, for I shall again praise Him, the help of my countenance and my God. And so, we don't know the exact time and place of these writings. I take it, again, that this is David as the psalmist here. It's a time when he's away from the tabernacle. And this person, David, or whichever writer here, they really want to be there. They want to be at worship, and they cannot. And you know, they suffered here when they're physically cut off from the place, like when David was in the wilderness for years, literally, being chased by Saul. He couldn't get to the tabernacle. Remember, where was it? Where was the very first place when David fled from Saul that final time? Where did David go? He went to the tabernacle. He went to the priest at Nob. What happened when he was there? He asked for some food, and they didn't have any. He ended up taking the showbread. He asked for a sword. And how many did they have? They were priests. They didn't have any but one. They had the one he gave them. The sword he had taken from Goliath and given to God as a tribute. And then because one of the wicked servants of Saul had seen David go there and get that little meager bit of help, they end up killing all the priests. How could David go worship? And what did the law say to do? Go to a particular place and worship. You know, we in the New Testament, we are so blessed. Where can we go to worship? To church. Where's that? Wherever we are. Wherever two or three are gathered. We can never be cut off like this. But from somewhere far away, driven away from his homeland by a captivity, by a flight, by a retreat, by you know, some think this is David in the time of Absalom when he was driven from Jerusalem. I think more likely probably younger David, but driven away from the place where God was worshipped. And so when he's out there, notice verse 3. He's thirsting for God, and what does verse 3, what do they say to him? Where is your God? And in verse 10, they say to me all day long again, where is your God? If we would put that in modern parlance, we'd say it how we say today, somebody would say, where's your God now? Chosen one. You think about David. The one blessed of God, the one that God's favor shined upon from the time that Samuel anointed him. The one who was risen up in the kingdom so quickly with the killing of Goliath coming to public consciousness, being, well, even before that, in the court of Saul as a musician, being the best friend of the crown prince, Jonathan. Favored David. You think about the charmed life he led up until that time that Saul started chunking spears at him. And now, I think, is probably this time when he's in exile from then. But now he's in exile. And so what do those wags say? What do those who oppose him say? What do the cynics say? Where's your God now? What do they say to us when they know we're Christians? When we talk about the favor of God that has come to us, when we thank God for the many blessings that he has given us, and then comes a day when things are hard and difficult, what does that unfair and unfaithful and unbelieving person say? Where's your God now? Now, your mama always said, if you can't say nothing nice, don't say nothing at all. But what about the devil and his people? They don't abide by that rule, do they? You know, there's a term that's been borrowed into English from German. It's called Schadenfreude or Schadenfreude. It is the term that is specifically describes laughing at another person's misfortune. Now, I'm sad that we have a term like that in our language. At least we had to borrow it. At least we didn't have one of our own. But there are people that laugh at others' misfortune. Here is a guy in misfortune, and he's in misfortune enough that the unbeliever sees in trouble. And so, again, the exact circumstances aren't told, but that's not good when the unbeliever can say, you know, you're having a bad go, aren't you? Where's your God now? And so that's a bad circumstance. You ever felt that way? We sometimes say within ourselves, why is God letting this happen? Why is God doing this? That'll be that lesson on why do bad things happen to good people. Well, because Satan's out there doing it. Sorry, I already gave up Thursday's lesson. Don't tell him. It's not God doing it. It's Satan. God made this world good. Everything in this world was good and very good before sin entered the world, right? And you think about man in the state of paradise. He had a wife and a job. Those are not curses of Satan. That's what he had in paradise, and it was very good. And then Satan ruined it all. And so here is a time when things are going bad. It's of Satan. And who does Satan have you blame? God. Satan causes it and then blames God for it. And so here David is afflicted by that guy saying that. And as he said there in verse 3, my tears have been my food night and day. I've been eating nothing but tears. You ever been so bad off you wouldn't eat? I know you're looking at me saying, you never had it that bad, did you? No. You're not the only funny one here, man. All right, so when you're really in grief, it's hard to eat, isn't it? How many times have you had to console someone and sit with them? And what's one of the things you say? Here, eat something. Why? Because people aren't eating and they need to keep their strength up. But here he has been in tears enough to kill his appetite. Again, he's thirsting for God. He's panting, the deer panting. While I was out there at David's house, man, if any poor antelope wanders down that valley, he's going to be panting for a long time. But imagine out there the wildlife. I don't know where they get their water, but how much do they want to get to the water hole? They need to get to the water hole. They ain't going to make it. He needs to get here to God. He needs to get to the spiritual water hole. And all he's got is his own tears to feed him. This is bad. And so, as we talked about, he's kept from worship. That couldn't happen to us to the same degree. Again, I do note, you know, this. I think this is David, but David said, I was glad when they said to me it was time to go to the house of the Lord. And here he talked about leading the processions. And I think about, again, those years of David, those wonderful years of his very early adulthood, you know, when he was the right-hand man for Saul, right? He was there playing. He was the chief musician of Saul. He was the guy who could cheer him up. He was the best friend of the crown prince, Jonathan, who appeared to be coming to be the next king. He had fame from killing Goliath. And what does it appear that he spent his time doing? Leading the festival. You think about the great throngs who would come to the tabernacle at the yearly feast. Now, I know the Jews didn't observe those fully as they should, but somebody came to those things, didn't they? Didn't the priests have worship there at those Passover and Feast of Tabernacles and those other things? And who was one of the, as we would say today, lay leaders? Not a priest, but someone actively taking part and seen in it. And you think about David and his skill as a musician and known to be the king's chief man. Why, when they need the instruments played in the processions, why, who would they ask to play? Can you not see him walking in front of the crowds playing? Can you not see him leading them in song? You know, when Solomon did build the temple after David had laid up so many mounds of materials, and David set the priests in their courses, and he ordered the musicians, and he ordered Asaph to lead the musicians, ordered the sons of Korah to break into the choruses. You think about David, who spent all that time in organizing that worship. He loved that, didn't he? He had a mind for that. And here, I think we should picture him in his early days leading that worship in those favored years before Saul turned against him. And then from that, he's off in that valley. Sometimes, isn't he literally on one side of the rock while Saul's on the other? He's on top of the rock talking to Saul down off the road. David is in these kind of places, hiding out for years. Eventually, even living with the Philistines, right? Right there before Saul was killed. And so can you imagine that circumstance? And here it comes time for the Passover. Here it comes time for one of the feasts. And David's over there with the Philistines in Gath. Or David's out there in this dry, terrible place. He's in the valley of despair. So he's kept from worship and he's far from home. Now, notice what he did say, even far from home. I will worship God. I will praise God. In verse 6, from the land of the Jordan, from the peaks of Hermon and Mount Mizar. You know, Mount Mizar and Mount Hermon, the mighty mountains of Lebanon, the snow-capped mountains topped by those wonderful massive cedars. Of course, David eventually will send a whole bunch of those down, and Solomon too, to build the temple of God. That's not a bad place to be. And if that's the only place you can praise God from, do it. But that's still not home, is it? That's still not home. And so he's far from home. He is an exile from his own place. And next we note, he says he is forgotten. He says he is rejected. Again, those lines, verse 9. Verse 9 that echoes the words of Jesus on the cross. I say to God, my rock, why have you forgotten me? I am mourning because of the oppression of my enemy. That gets us the next one. He's oppressed. So he feels forgotten of God and oppressed and rejected. Verse 2 of chapter 43, why hast thou rejected me? So we do note even the faithful. And would you, David or whoever, the writer of this psalm, would we class them as faithful? Absolutely. But does he not feel forgotten and rejected? Now we do know that's still a step better or two than the person who says that God did this to me. He says, I'm in all this trouble because God just forgot about me. Now, I don't think God did forget about him. And he says that I'm working on this and I should not despair. But he says, I feel forgotten and I feel rejected. Now, that's bad enough. What about these people who wrongly say, God is afflicting me? That's a whole other step, isn't it? Forgotten's bad enough. But afflicted directly, that's a whole other step. And he never says that. And I don't think we should either. I don't think we should ever say God is afflicting us. Because I know who's the source of evil in this world. And it's not the Father of lights. Right? But can we as faithful people not but from time to time feel forgotten and rejected? As though the blessing, the protection, that shelter of God. And I think that's what he means here when he says God is my rock. That I feel like you're not with me. And why is that? Again, because of this oppression of these evil ones and this bad circumstance. Verse 2 again of 43. I go on mourning because of the oppression of the enemy. And again, verse 1 of that chapter 43. He said, plead against an ungodly nation. Deliver me from a deceitful and unjust man. Now, if I take this to be David, then obviously I think that's Saul. In David's life, there were times he was oppressed by other evil men. Even his own son Absalom for a time. But I think this is most likely Saul. But notice, it's an evil and unjust man. Again, it's an unethical enemy that we as Christians fight. We do not fight an enemy that fights fair. We fight an enemy that's full of deceit, right? How does he get us to sin usually? Tricks us. What does he say about us even if we don't do anything bad? He accuses us. He's the father of lies. He's the accuser of the brethren. We are never in a fair fight, are we? No. But we're stronger than him and better than him, and we're blessed of God and protected of God. But here is David fighting an ethical enemy. And let me ask you, when were the enemies of the people of God ever ethical about it? You fought very many ethical enemies? That's just how it goes. But this is the set of circumstances and the consequences of the circumstances, like, you know, the being far from home and kept from worship, that's a consequence of the circumstance, but that's just a compounding thing. So these circumstances have compounded and got worse, and I think if that were my situation, I'd be in that valley of despair, maybe under one of those rocks. And so we don't chide the psalmist here for being in the valley of despair, because I think most thoughtful people would be in the valley of despair. And there's things that happen in this world, and if you think about them, don't we always try to reconcile things? How can a good God allow this to happen, right? How is it that if it's supposed to work these things for our good, Romans 8, how is it working this way now? How is it that all these things that God has promised for good are going to work out? Where's the blessings that are promised? Where's these things? The thoughtful person is going to be in despair from time to time, I think. But that doesn't mean, we stay there, or two, we lose our faith. Just because we get off in this valley once or twice, or three times, or five times, or however in our life, does that mean it's all over and we ought to pack it in as Christians? What happens to people, though, who lose their faith in these moments? So some people, when they get there, they think that's all there is. But it's not. And what we know is, again, this is, if we're being thoughtful about things, we can still be faithful. We can be thoughtful in trouble and still faithful. This is from Romans chapter 4. This is about Abraham. And this is as Abraham, different circumstance, but same type thing, where Abraham is trying to think about how what God has promised is all going to come true. And we've got what God has said and what God does in blue. And we've got the actions of Abraham here in red. And read with me Romans 4, 17, beginning as it's written. Here's what God had said. A father of many nations have I made you. And it's talking about Abraham's response to this. In sight of him whom he believed. So Abraham believed in him. And God had said to Abraham, I've made you a father of many nations. This is God who gives life to the dead and calls into being that which does not exist. And so we're talking about God the creator and God the resurrector. Now if God can create life from nothing and give back life when it's over, God can do anything, right? And so God has the power and has demonstrated the power. And here, Abraham has believed in him. And he said, I will make you a father of many nations. So it says about that, in hope against hope he believed. And sometimes this is where we are. Now, we're children of Abraham, aren't we? We're children of Abraham by faith. Go Galatians 3, right? We are baptized into Christ Jesus, and we are children of Abraham if we are the faith of Abraham. So we are like Abraham, and sometimes we are in hope against hope believing. In hope against hope he believed, in order that he might become the father of many nations. So he believed and he received what was promised. According to what has been spoken, so shall your descendants be. And without becoming weak in faith, he contemplated. That's what this psalmist is having to do right here. That's what we have to do ourselves in times of despair. Without becoming weak, like this battery that's going off, but without becoming weak in faith, contemplate. Did Abraham think about how is it that I'm going to be the father of many nations when I don't even have yet a son? Think about 80-year-old Abraham. How am I going to be the father of many nations? Think about 90-year-old Abraham. And then think about 100-year-old Abraham. Now, Abraham, gotta say, wasn't completely perfect in this exercise. At one time he thought it helped God out, and he did have a son by Hagar, right? He had a son there named Ishmael. Whenever you go on God, whenever you go on your own plan and not God's, how's that work out? All right, so we got Ishmael and all his descendants, even to this day. All right, that's a different lesson. But without, he was trying to work out for how this could be. Now again, he came up with his own solution, but it was wrong, and it caused problems. Again, think about another time. Even after God gave him that son, what did God do some 10, 12, 15, 18 years later with that son? Go sacrifice him. And what did Abraham do? Got up early in the morning and went. Right? And Isaac carried the wood for the sacrifice up the mountain, just like Christ carried the cross. Isaac, the sacrifice, carried the wood. And Abraham put him on the altar. And Abraham was ready to stick the dagger in him. And what did Abraham think then? God would raise him from the dead. Now, Abraham was wrong again, but he acted right. See, sometimes we like Abraham here, and this is a side note. This is just purely extra for your edification. Sometimes we think wrong and do wrong, and what happens? We get an Ishmael, right? And how that didn't work out good. But sometimes we might think a little bit off, but do right. Like, go ahead and sacrifice him, thinking God will raise him. Abraham was a little bit wrong in that, wasn't he? But what did he do? What did he do wrong? Nothing. And so, what was the result? The result was good, wasn't it? And so, when we don't act all wrong, we can sometimes salvage ourselves. We can be a little bit off sometimes in our thinking, but if we don't act wrong, then we don't make the problem worse and worse and worse, right? And so Abraham had thought God had raised him from the dead. So he acted in faith. He acted exactly as God wanted him to. It worked out well. But Abraham, this whole time, when he's waiting on this son for years, when he has this son years, but years go by and he's the only son he's got, right? And he's told to sacrifice him, and he does. Abraham is thinking. Abraham is contemplating. What is it that the unbelievers sometimes wrongly and slanderously say about Christians? You people don't think. You let other people do your thinking for you. No, we don't. We're the thoughtful ones. We're the ones thinking this thing all the way through, right? You cannot be faithful without being thoughtful, can you? You can't do it. So Abraham contemplated things, and he didn't know the answer to everything, but he contemplated how? Without becoming weak in faith. What happens if our contemplations get us off into cynicism and skepticism and doubtful things about God's Word and doubting the Scriptures and doubting God's promise? Our contemplations take us down the wrong path, make us weak. What if we contemplate scripturally? What if we think about the Bible? What if we're fed on the Scriptures? We can contemplate without being weak in faith. Because Abraham thought about what God said, and he trusted in what God said. So even though his own body was as good as dead, since he was 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb, yet in respect to the promise of God, he did not waver in unbelief. He kept believing that in spite of the fact he's old and Sarah's not had no kids yet, for he's 100. But he kept thinking to himself and believing that God would do it. He grew strong. So he didn't become weak, he grew strong. If you're not growing strong, you're probably doing what? Getting weak. If you're getting strong, though, you're on the right path. He grew strong in faith. How do you grow strong in faith? You give glory to God. Okay, this battery's getting weak, but our faith won't. So give glory to God. And he was fully assured that what God promised, he could perform. So, that was reckoned to him as righteousness. In Romans 4, faith is reckoned as righteousness. We are to be faithful, and that is counted as righteousness. Work for Abraham or work for us. And so, Abraham, in things that he could not figure out and how humanly possible it would be. Because how humanly possible can a 100-year-old man and a 90-year-old woman have a baby and then from that one son grow to a great nation? You know, and then you think about it, Isaac, boy, for a long time, he didn't have kids, and he had two, and one of those, well, you know, you know how Esau was. But from then, from Jacob, through the unfaithfulness and trickery of Laban, ends up prospering Jacob with his family, so he has 12 sons. Well, you know about 11 of those. But in any case, from that motley crew, from those guys, God makes the nation of Israel. And God did make the nation of Israel, just as he told Abraham he would. So Abraham contemplated. And when we're stuck in situations and we don't know how this is going to be, yes, we're going to think about it and we're going to contemplate. But don't become weak in faith in your contemplations. Grow strong in faith in your contemplations. Think about the promise of God and be assured more and more of what God has promised. He has the ability to perform, because he's the one, again, as it says, gives life to the dead and brings into being that which did not exist. The very fact we're here in this world is here is proof of what God can do. So we contemplate, and the psalmist contemplated, and the psalmist then took some actions in the text. He took actions which leads him out of the valley. He's in the valley, but he's already taken the actions that will lead him out. First off, in all of this, he keeps longing for God. As the deer pants for water, so my soul pants after thee. He keeps longing for God. What happens when we stop longing for God? We get to stay in the valley. Whenever you give up, whenever you're in the valley and stop looking, you know, if you're out there literally lost in a valley, what might you look for? The North Star, right? Well, you might look for a landmark. You might look for a trail. What happens if you're in that valley and sit down under a rock and give up? What happens in your faith life? What happens in your spiritual life if you're in the valley of despair and give up? And so he keeps longing for God. As Isaiah told us, he said, "Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call him when he's near." Seek the Lord when he can be found. Sometimes these times of trouble in our life is when the Lord is nearest. Sometimes the Lord will use these things for our good and for our strengthening. Sometimes this thing that has us in despair may be like Paul, a thorn in the flesh. And God said, "My grace is sufficient for you." And he said he was Paul would be strong in his weakness. And he was dropped closer to God by a thing that for others would destroy him. And so sometimes in this place of despair, if we long for God, we can be closest to him. Another way to get out, another key to action here to take us out of the valley is remembering the good that God had done and the good that we had done. In verse 4 he says, "These things I remembered and I pour out my soul. I used to go along with the throng and lead them in the procession of the house of God with the voice of joy and thanksgiving and the multitude in the festival." He remembered when things were good. You know, there are some, aren't they, that only remember the bad things? Sometimes when we don't have in this life as we wish, we think about all that we lack. You know, and maybe we should remember all the things that God had given us for so very long. Well, thank you, sir. So we remember and should remember, like the psalmist, what God has done for us. And here, what we should do for God. Because what is he remembering? When he was active in service, he's remembering that he worshiped God and he led the things of the time of God. He's not going to forget that. And so he wants to get back to it. So he's going to remember things as they should be. And then he hopes. Notice verse 8. "The Lord will command his loving kindness in the daytime, and his song will be with me in the night, a prayer to the God of my life." God will be with me. That's confidence, isn't it? Where is he now? He's in the valley of despair. Where is he now? Is he enjoying the loving kindness of God in the day? Is he singing the songs of God in the night? No, he's crying bitter tears. But what will be again? Blessings will return. For those of you who has passed through in times of your life, these troubles, heartaches, in difficult circumstances, when it got bad, did it stay bad all the time? As there was a dip down, was there not also a corresponding rise back up? And so things are not forever bad. What if we dwelt on only the bad? What if we thought it would never get any better? You know, why is it that unbelievers' suicide rates are so much worse than believers? We have some hope. Concentrate on your hope. Think about hope. Also, we note again, he's preparing for worship. Well, one, he's writing this song to the sons of Korah, right? He's writing this song to sing in the tabernacle one day. Where does he expect to be and what does he expect to hear one day? So the very fact he's writing this song, he's preparing for worship. But we also note verse 4. He said, these things I remember, or excuse me, 43:4. I was reading 42:4. 43:4. Then I'll go to the altar of God, to God my exceeding joy, and upon the lyre I shall praise thee, O God my God. On the lyre I shall praise thee. I almost picture David here not having his instrument. And boy, I'm going to get it back. But we think about it here. I'm going to worship God. I was doing that before. I'm going to do that again. And we note his prayer. He's going to pray to God. As he says in verse 8 we just read, the Lord will command his loving kindness in the daytime, his song in the night, a prayer to the God of my life. He will be praying to God. He is going to be praising God. So worship with prayer and praise. And then, I don't know if we've noticed, this will be the first time we comment, but did you notice he's having this conversation in this psalm with himself? As he says there in verse 5, why are you in despair, O my soul? Why are you disturbed? Hope in God. Who's the one who's cheering up this person who's in despair? The person who's in despair. Why are you in despair, O my soul? Hope in God. That's verse 5. Notice verse 11. Why are you in despair, O my soul? Why have you become disturbed? Hope in God. And again, verse 5 of chapter 43. Why are you in despair, O my soul? Three times we have this, right? Who is he telling, why are you in despair? He's telling himself. Now, it would be nice, wouldn't it? I see Brother Mickey in despair. Brother Mickey, why are you in despair? Hope in God. That'd be a good thing, wouldn't it? But what if Brother Mickey's having none of it? What if Brother Mickey, instead of waiting for me to come, because I live a long way away, and I may not know he's in despair, Brother Mickey said to himself, Mickey, why are you in despair? Right? What if Jay says to himself, Jay, why are you in despair? What if Brother James? James, why are you in despair? The psalmist is having this conversation with himself. Now he pours it out in the song, and he does it for, as it says in Romans chapter 15, he does this for our instruction, right? These lessons are all for us. But he writes this down, his inward conversation with himself, so that we might learn what? To be strong through his efforts, right? The fact that he went through this, a godly man, the man after God's own heart, a man of such importance in God's plan, you know, the great-great-great-great-grandpappy of Jesus himself, The head of the great lineage of kings of Judah, the man who did so much, if that fellow had those problems, what can we say? Well, maybe we'll have him too. But we note that he strengthened himself. And who might be one of the most important people to you when you have despair? You. Right? You. You. And so strengthen yourself. Now, one thing, as I say, I noticed, and when I was studying this, I looked at that list, and that list looked awful familiar to me. One of my favorite books to teach is the book of Hebrews. And I thought, you know what? I have seen this whole list of things in the book of Hebrews. Think about it. Long for God. What does it say? Hebrews 11 and 6. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and he's a rewarder of those who seek him. We teach that when we teach the plan of salvation, don't we? We teach young converts, seek for God, believe in God. We have to teach ourselves these same lessons, don't we, when we get in trouble? All the lessons we teach the new converts, believe, what do we got to keep on doing every day? Repent, what do we got to do when we sin? Confess, what do we got to keep on doing? Now be baptized, no, we don't have to be rebaptized. But we do have to remember in Romans 6 that we made a change, right? And then we teach the young ones, be faithful. What do we got to teach ourselves? Four of those five exactly. And one of them, remember that we did it and what change it affected. And so these basic things, we got to teach ourselves again. So if you're in the valley, the book of Hebrews says what? Search for God, seek for God. And remembrance, over in Hebrews chapter 10, the Hebrews, and they were in a weakness, maybe not in despair of circumstance, but the Hebrew brethren were getting weak, were they not? What was going to lead them out of their troubles? Remembering the faithfulness that they'd had and the way they ought to serve God now, just like they used to. Hebrews 10:32, remember the former days when, after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of suffering, partly by being made public spectacle through reproaches and tribulation, partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. And you showed sympathy to those who were prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and an abiding one. And here's where, if you're in the valley of despair, or here if you're in the wavering of unfaithfulness, look at verse 35. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has great reward. And so an active remembrance so that you could keep doing that. Now, I know sadly for some, faithfulness is but a memory. But if there's a flicker there, fan it. If there's a flame there, build it up, strengthen it. If there's an ember going, keep it going. And so remember what you've been doing and keep on doing it. And so out of the valley of despair or out of unfaithfulness, either one, that, and then hope. Think about the hope in Hebrews 6. And maybe this was actually the one where I first saw the way for this list to be. The writer of the Psalms had great hope. And in Hebrews 6, it tells us there about the promises of God. We studied Abraham just a second ago, right, in Romans 4. In Romans 4, we studied about Abraham and his faithfulness. Well, in Hebrews 6, it talks about Abraham as well and his faithfulness to the promise of God. In Romans 4, it's about what Abraham did. He kept believing. In Hebrews 6 part, it's about what God did. God kept promising and kept assuring. Hebrews 6:17, in the same way God. So we read what Abraham did, now here's what God did. In the same way God, desiring all the more to show the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, interposed with an oath, in order that by two unchangeable things in which it's impossible for God to lie, we may have strong encouragement. We who have fled for refuge and laying hold of the hope set before us. This hope in God and what God promised. This hope we have as an anchor for the soul. A hope both sure and steadfast. And so what God says is our hope if we stick to it. And so we see hope just like the psalmist. So in Hebrews, what's the solution? There it was about circumstances and bad problems in life. Here it's about being faithful. Hope. Remembrance and hope. Also prepare to worship. Remember how the psalmist said he would go to worship and how he used to lead the throngs to worship and how he wants to sing the praise of God and worship? What's Hebrews chapter 10? Don't forsake what? The time of worship. Your own assembling together. Do not forsake your own assembling together. Hebrews 10:23 and 24. And in verse 25, then it says, after consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds, it says, do not forsake your own assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you say the day drawing near. Hold fast, verse 23, to the confession of your hope without wavering, and come to worship. hold to your confession, and come to worship. That's the solution to a lot of problems, isn't it? Hold fast and worship God. What happens when the big waves come? Hold fast and worship God. What happens when all the little waves come right after the other? One after the other after the other. Hold fast and worship God. What about when there's an earthquake? Aren't we always overdue out here forever? Hold fast and worship God. You know, I tell you, I was up in Oakdale at that gospel meeting. That friend of mine who's a gospel preacher up there, his great-granddaddy was a gospel preacher in Oklahoma in 1910. Guess what happened in 1910 in Oklahoma? They had a big old earthquake. He baptized 1,000 people that year. I don't know how many of them stayed steady. Maybe we need some more of those earthquakes. But what happens when troubles come? Some people do turn to God, but some people are destroyed. Sometimes the rocks roll down and crush them. And sometimes what we have to do is just climb up and hold on tighter. But hold fast and worship God. And then prayer and praise. What's Hebrews 13? What's that tell us to do? What's it tell those Hebrew Christians to do? Hebrews 13 and 15. Through him then let us offer up continually a sacrifice of praise to God. That is the fruit of lips giving thanks to his name. And so praise and pray to God. What happens when a Christian stops praying? When we think about Abraham again in Romans 4, we read about him. What did he do? Is he contemplated these things and didn't waver in unbelief? He glorified God. What are we to do? Glorify God. And then lastly, now, okay, yes, this one I didn't find in the book of Hebrews. I looked, I did not find strengthen yourself. Well, maybe every exhortation is to strengthen yourself. But in Hebrews, there is certainly the exhortation to strengthen others, right? So strengthen yourself, yes, and strengthen others. In Hebrews 3, verses 12 and 13, one of my favorite books, passages in all of Hebrews. Hebrews 3, 12, take care, brethren, lest there should be in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart in falling away from the living God. That is that person who gets in despair and stays there, isn't it? That is the person who wavers. That is the person who grows cold. But encourage one another day after day while it's still called today, lest any of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. So in Hebrews it says strengthen each other. And so the Hebrew writer and the psalmist, you'd almost think they're reading from the same book, right? They're on the same page, aren't they? And so here's the actions to get out of the valley. In Hebrews, it's a spiritual valley. It's unfaithfulness. In the book of Psalms in 42 and 3, it's physical trauma and troubles. And we can have either or both, right? And sometimes they both come at once. Long for God. Remember your service and your faith. Keep hoping. Prepare to worship. Give prayer and praise. And strengthen yourself and others. One more parallel. As we go journeying through the valley, when I did visit that place a few weeks ago, again, on my way home after being in a meeting with a good church and with a good friend and seeing the grandness of Yosemite and seeing the glory there, the High Sierras, when saw Mount Whitney just before this, or what I could see over from the clouds. But when Lizzie and I got to that place, you know, we didn't want to stay very long. After the High Sierras, after Yosemite, knowing that home is when we finish that car trip, that place didn't seem very attractive at all. We got there long enough just to strike it. I don't even think we took two steps from the car. We both stood up outside. Standing in the open door of the car, took our pictures of that valley and left. All right, we've done that one. Let's get out of here. Compared to all the other grand places we'd been and knowing that we were going home, we didn't want to be at that place in the least. And one of the things that happens with troubles in this world, and one of the things that God uses them for, is in the book of Hebrews chapter 11, teaching us that we should desire a better place. When you know that these troubles are here in the world below, when you know that the world is full of these type of woes, why would you want to stay? Why wouldn't you want to set your heart on home? Get back in the car and go there. And that's what we did. Well, we had to go through Bakersfield. See, there's always more troubles, aren't there? But set your heart on home. And long for a better place than this. As it says in Hebrews 11 about the faithful, all these died in faith without receiving the promises. But having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance, And having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. See, this world is not our home. We're not here permanently. We're strangers and pilgrims. For those who say such things make it clear they're seeking a country that is their own. If indeed they've been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. The separation and pain and troubles and trials that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the rest went through, those things taught them that there's a better place, the place of God, and a place that we should seek. And so when Lizzie and I got through that valley, we went home. In this life, we'll go through various valleys, and then we will go home, will we not, if we're faithful to a home prepared? One more thing. After I selected this picture for this, I was looking for another picture in my photo album, and you know what? I found another picture of this place. Aside from this picture, which is close up to this little valley, I also found this picture. Now, I don't know if you can see this very well. This picture is taken from coming down off Mount Whitney, 6,000 feet up. And this little hump right here, I wish I was brighter, but that little hump right there is where we took that picture, and that little valley right there. Now, you couldn't tell when you're in that valley, but we were right beside the road. And so we went down that road and we turned in that valley. But when you got in that valley, you couldn't see anything but just the boulders around you. And so we turned around and went out the way we came and headed down this road and on toward home. But that little bitty hump right there, you know, if you're in that valley, that's all you can see, right? Hard to see anything else. But if you get a little bit of a bird's eye view, we were right there. That's from up here on Mount Whitney. That's not anything, is it? That's nothing. Now, if you were down there stranded, though, how much would it seem like? What if you just took a different view? From 6,000 feet up, that little valley's nothing. Now, let me ask you, what if we took a higher view? What if you viewed that little valley right there from heaven? Get out your earth magnifying glass. We'd never find it, would we? Now, think about the troubles we're in, the valleys of despair that we're in this life. When we're in them, it's all we can see, isn't it? We don't see nothing else. Do we realize that we're just in a little bitty clump and right over there behind us is the road home? Do we realize if we go around that curve and then the next one or go up and over that hill, we're done? And do we realize if we view this from the after while that it's nothing at all? It's not even a bump. It's a nothing. But when we're in it, what does it seem like? And so put it in perspective. Realize that for every trouble and trial in this life, there is a sufficient comfort, a sufficient grace, and there is an incomparable amount of glory in the afterwhile. And so be faithful. Yes, we think about these things. We must contemplate them, but contemplate them like Abraham in faith. Grow strong in faith and not waver in unbelief. And soon that is just a little bit of a place we went through. And we'll tell the story to our grandkids. Oh, I remember we passed through there. Yeah, that was hard for a little bit. But yeah, we had a rough patch back a ways. But what was that compared to what's ahead and what is laying in store for us in the Lord? And so with that, we close our lesson, our study of Psalm 42 and 3 in the Valley of Despair. Realizing that when we're there, it seems big. Realizing that when we're in it, sometimes it's hard to see anything else. But like the psalmist, we keep longing for God. We keep remembering what was. We think in hope of what will be. And by faith, we prepare to see it. With that then, we'll ask you if you need to come and confess Jesus so as to be baptized, repenting of your sin, if you need to come and confess sin, and again, walk in Him and do as you should. Or if you need any of the prayers or spiritual help that the brethren here can give, we'd offer it to you now as we extend the invitation and stand and sing.
Cleansing power, are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? Are you fully trusting?
Moses comes forward. They see